Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have in the studio with us poet Sarah Zale. Sarah has published two collections of poetry, The Art of Folding, which came out in 2010, inspired by her travels to Israel and Palestine with the Compassionate Listening Project. And her other book, Sometimes You Do Things, was published in 2013 by Aquarius Press, Living Detroit series, which highlights the history of Detroit and celebrates its rebuilding. Born and raised in Detroit, she now teaches writing and social justice at Cascadia College in Seattle, and Sarah lives in Port Townsend. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited about getting started hearing about your life in poetry. So let's begin with the question, how do you describe yourself as a poet?
It's pretty safe to say that I'd call myself a poet of witness. Poetry should touch our spiritual lives. It should do as Dickinson said, it should knock your head off. And much like Rilke said, which is it should change your life. And it should be not so much just a conversation with the self. It should be with the larger community.
Yeah, and we're going to get to parts of our talk today where you are definitely impacting the larger community. So before we do that, though, I'm very intrigued by your first book coming out, The Art of Folding, post your travels to Israel and Palestine. And is there a story behind that book and those travels?
Well, it's a long sequence poem. So it's a collection of poems that are really one long poem. And it's focused on the metaphor of folding, which how I see it is kind of like not a closing, but it's the experience of when you place your hands, your fingers together, and you take a deep breath and you breathe into yourself. It's a spiritual state. What happens in the book is the word fold is repeated, and the idea of transforming the word and transforming your own experiences by this repetition. So the book is intended to read from beginning to the end. And a little backstory on it is that it is a listening. I went with the Compassionate Listening Project to Israel and Palestine, and the idea was to listen to both sides, to find the balance. So I'm going to read a poem that is first the experience of listening to a Jew and then also to an Arab. And remember, I'm opening in the middle of the book. Shira spends time with the prickly pear, a sabra whenever she can. Jewish pain, she explains. Inside, the flesh is soft, sweet. Not even the cactus understands. She points to its shallow cast of roots 10 feet away. She touches a spine. She bleeds. She holds a black and white photo of Tova and Hana, Yahiel and Aaron, the children of Marsh Mendel. She says, doesn't say, see, here are my wounds, my family, of Poland, of Horzele, a shtetl, a town where the Nazis held the first Jews. She remembers at the knee of her mother the story of 200 Jews, how they burned as other Jews danced down the site of Nazi guns. She leans into her listening, hears Tova and Hana scream for their brothers. Their blood flushes her cheeks. I want to give her comfort, to find a scab, to let everything escape. I pick. Perhaps they were not in the synagogue, I say. She says, you're right. Perhaps instead they died of hunger in Warsaw, in a ghetto, or danced their last words in Auschwitz.
Hmm. You certainly made an impact. You certainly reached beyond a conversation just with yourself. Thank you. Now we hear the second poem.
This one is about a man who belongs to Hamas, the Sunni resistance group that we Americans associate only with great violence. The tide of fealty ebbs from where you stand before us, a white square on your head, a black cord holding it in place. We wade in a quiet ripple around you. Your head tilts slightly, as if listening. On the wall, a black and white kafia and a face as familiar as any on an American dollar. Abu Ammar, father of Ammar. We called him simply Arafat, gone this day 2 years. You speak of ties to Hamas. Your words like the moon rile the seas. You speak of a drop of water, you say, it can dent the hardest of things. You speak of the eyes of your son, how the soldiers' cloud slipped in with the night to arrest you. You speak of what is good, what is right for your people, you, Abu, you, the mayor of Beit Omar. You say you cried, though you are a man, cried for your son that he learn of hate, learn of hard. You know how the wound of a man is passed down to his sons, to his people. The man who can fold metes out no wounds. I say you are rock, you are stone, you are water. You say you are the moon. I see how your moon can calm the seas. I call you Abu in the art of seeing. I call you poet. What do I do with this man of Hamas, who is pleased, who smiles? Mm.
Did the people that you spoke with get to read your poems after you wrote them?
Not that I know of.
They live inside of you, though.
Yes.
Thank you. Now, there must be a story also to your second book, Sometimes You Do Things, and the reason I'm thinking it's more of a story is because you grew up in Detroit, and it was published by a Detroit press. Does it have to do with Detroit?
I was born and raised in Detroit, so really my identity was formed out of civil rights and protest and an awareness of social injustice. Two images inform the poems in this book: the riots in the late 60s and the recession of 2007 and 8. An apocalyptic reality. Detroit has had to rebuild from scratch. I was fascinated by the story of a big city in this country, pretty much razed to the ground, and communities coming together and trying to figure out, how do we start from scratch? You know, kind of a Stephen King or any sort of the apocalyptic stories that are coming out now. And they built gardens, and they spoke to one another. They became community. I'll read a couple poems from here. The first one is called Ice House Detroit. Some say the world began in fire. In the summer of civil rights, Detroit burned. I gathered smoldering strips of door and lintel, dresser and chair, to remember the heat, because that's what the young do. The young eat fire. They say God threw an orb of blaze into the sky and called it earth. Sitting flint and cross-legged in a place not yet ache or hope, God created steel and called it man, created tinder and called it woman. One day the land cooled. It is winter. The city is block after block of one home here and one there. Hands with missing fingers. The eyes of the people are no longer wide with yes. Their mouths recline, unastonished. An old man circles a cart from the store down the street that is no longer there. It is full of the things that keep him alive, a gallon of water, a skillet, a blanket. Matches, cardboard, and a ball of broken string, a clock with one hand, three volumes of Dante's Journey. Trucks with a dim memory of red scream down the pockmarked streets. Legs of people leap from the trucks. Hoses spill out behind them like fat tongues that will slither and gorge with water. The arms of the people raise the hose to a house with a peeling paint and slipping roof and doors like too much blush on tired cheeks. Long-toothed icicles at the roofline grow instantly. Ice fills the Victorian corbels of gingerbread trim. Spray freezes in the air, falls and melts on the faces. Ashen light glistens on the ice of tattered lace below the lintel of each window. As their magic lingers, the hoses rest. 19,999 more houses of ice wait. Everyone knows the stories. Steel cats for demolition hunger for the melt. At night when they howl, all living things turn in their sleep. The streets of Detroit felt at first a shift. The people remember God cross-legged on the barren earth, but have forgotten the sound of his voice. They say the world has lost its center. They remember the wind as flames. Their lungs have forsaken fire for air. They thirst for ice. Detroit is not itself. The young gather on Woodward Avenue with their ears pressed to the line down the center of the city. When they look up, some say the body is still warm. Some say they hear a beat. God, who is always listening, tries again. In the beginning.
Thank you. It must have been very painful to grow up in a place and then see all this devastation. And I can imagine that it's heartening that they started with gardens and they came together and they talked to each other. And very touched by what keeps that man alive, the man in your poem, who's carting around what keeps him alive, including literature.
To see gardens grow around skyscrapers that have been abandoned, and like to share the poem about the people that created these gardens. And it's called Sweet Peas and a Blush of Radicchio. Young and not yet awake from a dream, we believe in wings rising on fire, burning in myth. Now, truth is more quantum. We count the seeds we plant. We are patient. We believe in something primal, in nothing more than the slip of soil through our hands. It has finally come to this. It is weary, the sun, finding its way back from behind a civilized sky. It is tender, our wait for the peel of petal upon petal of an artichoke to reach the heart. We understand again the unfolding of story, the draw of quiet and a presence so simple and alive. We know the answer. Buildings empty or of vernal use scratch the sky, give morning or afternoon shade to the Swiss chard spinach and kale, arugula, broccoli, beets, the climb of sweet peas, the blush of radicchio. Youth arrive to work on the gardens. They surround Malik like bees to pollinate the crops. The air smells like honey. Brother Rick sits on the corner of Meldrum and St. Paul, pans the rows of onions, endive, basil, butterleaf, lettuce, squash, and beans. He recalls tilling the land, a mix of earth and things that recall a human life. A plastic fork, a bone, china plate, a rose teacup with no handle, a timer, a tea ball, a recipe for soup. He remembers the homes. Charity, Rhizome, in her reach, sits with the young girls and watches them watch what she plants. She listens. She waits for spring. Wayne and Myrtle smile at their son as he uproots a carrot, still clinging to the manna of rich soil, and eats.
Very nurturing poem. I can see how the press in Detroit would celebrate having your book in their series. Thank you for reading that one.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is talking with Port Townsend poet and activist Sarah Zale about her writing and the creation of a local community arts project.
If you were to talk about influences on your poetry beyond place and experience of people in their place, in the places you visit, who would you say are your influences?
I have a Polish heritage, and maybe that's some of the reason, but it's the Polish poets, Miłosz Szymborska, and also the Russian poets, Akhmatova and Asit Mandelstam. And I guess more recently is the German-Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. His books Open, Closed, Open.
They reach you at a level that's important because of their backgrounds, in their nationalities?
Well, that's part of it. Another part is I think I grew up, and maybe many Americans did, and it informs our culture even, is that kind of this Whitman, Song of Celebrating Myself. It's the I, it's the ethnocentric sense of defining who we are. And what I see with these other poets is more a collective memory, which I really see in particular Szymborska. Maybe you're familiar with a poem that's translated there, but for the grace.
I'm sure many people aren't, though, if you want to talk about how that influenced you.
It's just four stanzas. Let me share it. I think it's a powerful poem that has really influenced my sense of composition of poetry. It could have happened. It had to happen. It happened earlier, later, near, farther off. It happened, but not to you. You were saved because you were the first. You were saved because you were the last. Alone with others. On the right, on the left. Because it was raining, because of the shade, because the day was sunny. You were in luck. There was a forest. You were in luck. There were no trees. You were in luck. A rake, a hook, a beam, a break, a jam, a turn, a quarter inch, an instant. So you're here? Still dizzy from another dodge, close shave, reprieve, one hole in the net and you slip through. I couldn't be more shocked or speechless. Listen how your heart pounds inside me.
Mm. Do you write in the second person? Have you written poems in the you?
I don't think so. That's so a good question.
Yeah. So there's something else in that poem that resonates when you think about your own writing. And it's always hard to express how our influences influence us. I mean, sometimes they're just our go-to. When we want to hear the sound of poetry, this is who we read. And sometimes we can feel it, that there's something in our poem that, to us anyway, as the writer, sounds like that influence. Do you have anything like that?
It's somehow in this poem, maybe she empowers what I would like to write a bit. But I see it as like a finger pointing, and mm-hmm. I'm trying to be kinder.
Yeah, I love that, because she's talking to you. There's a you in that poem, and you're receiving it as you are the you. You're the recipient, and mm-hmm. it empowers you to write. I like that. I like the breath of maybe it was this, and maybe it was that, and you're in luck because of this, and because of this, because we are alive, and I think she's telling us that. One of the present things that you're doing is a very big project in Port Townsend, and it has to do with visual artists and poets, and it even has a name, at least a working title. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you might tell us a little bit about the project, especially how you began it, what intrigued you about creating this project, what it is, of course, and where we are with it now.
Bill Mawinney, who runs the poetry series at Northwind Arts Center, hosted a juried show. He had invited poets to submit their work, and they ended up with 10 poems, then asked visual artists if they would respond to those poems. So it was a reverse ekphrastic experience, and I have searched for what that name is called, and in my own world I call it Haiga, which is a response of a ink drawing to a haiku. But said in a broader sense, it could be a response of visual artists to the written word. So I started talking with a few artists and poets, and we thought, what if we got together a group of poets and visual artists and see if what collaboration could take place? What could we learn from one another? So that was the beginning of it, and 30 people came together, and we broke down into smaller groups and have been working ever since in our small groups. And we meet every 2 months in a potluck salon.
As a large group.
As a large group to share progress.
What are the highlights of what you see happening?
Well, I'll speak for myself to start with. And then in my small group, it's just been an amazing collaboration of two visual artists and another poet besides myself. As far as other groups, there's been the difficulties in some way of artists trying to figure out, how do I collaborate? How do I give up that ego? Or maybe it's something different, but that sense of control they need to have over their work. There's many people that will say, my gosh, I don't usually even let somebody into my studio, much less someone pick up a paintbrush and add to my painting. And poets, do we want someone giving us input for changing our lines? So it has been a phenomenal transformation of all these artists to figure out, what's the plus and the minus of working with others? What am I gaining? What am I losing? How is all this transforming me?
I joined in a little late, and I have a subgroup, and we have redefined how we work. The beginning of it was a kind of just understanding who we are, what we produce, painting and responding to the painting in poetry, the poets being made to paint, see how that feels. And now we're on to another kind of idea. So part of the collaboration, as it's felt to me, is just getting to learn how to work with particular others and what vision we might have for work we could do together and apart. So our own individual responses to any activity. I think it's a very magnanimous project on your part to put this together. And I know from attending the big potlucks that you try to keep us on track about what it is we're doing and what we think the project should be and what might it result in terms of informing a larger audience about collaboration. And I was very touched by one of our members, Allison Headland, who actually gone to the library to find books by artists and writers on collaboration, their own collaborations. And it was such a sweet moment to hear her sharing the history, maybe, of collaboration. I'm sure collaboration started day one. I mean, if nothing else, we collaborate with the world as writers, right? You can't write your poems unless you're speaking with those people and being in those places and really imagining the angst. So it's not like even we don't collaborate, but it's not usually with a bunch of human beings who are also artistically expressing themselves. So I just want to say that it's an amazing effort, and somebody always has to keep the effort together or we fly off in all directions, which might be part of collaboration. And you want to tell us about one of the efforts is a title for the project, and you've been kind of instrumental in inciting people to think about that.
We let it go for months about what our title was because as you're speaking about, a big part of the project is process versus product. And if things are in this constant flow of process and taking risks, should we call ourselves Roadstead, which is one we settled on?
And that means?
It's a safe harbor. And then some people said, well, I don't want to be safe. I am exploring. I am in this constant state of, like you talked about, Allison is going out and finding, exploring, doing research, coming back and discussing. All that is chaos. Are we Roadstead? No. How about, and this is maybe more for our smaller group, Jim Murphy found that a synonym for collaboration is running dogs, more in a pejorative way, but we still like the idea because my dogs often attend our little sessions here and they cause the chaos that keeps us
collaborating
or in yeah. humor, having some humor about what we're doing. The biggest question I think that is the glue for this group, is it process? Is it chaos? Is it transforming? Is it not being able to pin things down? Or is it still a focus on product? Like, I have to have this done. It has to be finished. There's an end point, and then I feel safe. So that's the excitement of the group.
It's very well described. I know that when you write a poem, it gets under your skin. You want to finish it, but you never know when it's finished exactly. So you might give yourself a deadline, but that might not mean you're going to reach it. On the other hand, there's been some excitement with painters starting to write poetry and poets starting to paint. Even the process of a name is very interesting. So thank you for talking about that. And I do know that there is some sort of deadline ahead because of North Wind, where the inception for the idea began there. And then a year later, in the fall of 2018, go ahead and tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we thought we'd push ourselves a little bit, just a little bit, towards product. And if not a complete product, at least something that informs us as well as informs our community about what our process has been, where we've stumbled, where we've found successes. I set it up with Northwind that next October we will show a product, something that we're doing. And so We have a mix-up. Sometimes we work on product. Yeah. What are we going to show? Let's keep working on the process.
Oh, great. I think it reflects what being an artist and a writer is. Process
Absolutely.
And product and product and process, and you never know which one you're doing necessarily. So before we leave the studio today, I wonder if you might leave us with another one of your poems.
This is the poem, actually, that I used as a suggestion to my smaller group, Running Dogs or Roadstead, whatever we'll call it. And from this, our recent project, Burgeoned. And this is called Buchenwald, or Such a Place by Any Other Name. And I dedicate it to Elie Wiesel, who is someone who was in the concentration camps of World War II, and also, I think, the experience when he was a very young boy really prompted him to become a social activist and eventually win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. Within the time, a leaf drifts from branch to ground, a boy can lose his way. A moment can swallow you, expand in your throat. You cannot breathe. It can turn you inside out. You hammer your fists at the walls of your silence. You walk the earth, offending everything in your raw flesh. You say, Father is lying over there. He dares not sleep, lest they toss him out with the dead. He has no joy in his eyes. He no longer sings. The sun avoids his face. All day long he calls out my name. I watch wings rise and dip across the sky. People cover their ears. My son, tell them not to beat me. I am too young, Father. My throat is empty. A ship is waiting. We must go. We have tried every ship, Father, to Palestine, to America, and all of Europe. Close your eyes. Dream the salt air. Come, I am thirsty. His eyes close. His tongue licks the air of memory, thin between his body against body. At times, it sleeps beside him or dies quietly beneath him. At times, it sweeps like a cloud across his face. I cannot breathe. Where is God and his mercy? Where is he? This is where, my Father. Hear him. He is you, calling out. He is me, the boy who left you alone to die. He is my whole life, keeping you alive.
Thank you. Sarah, I want to thank you. Your poetry has certainly helped me stay alive in the way that the world is right now, and I think proves what you're saying about our poetry does reach at a spiritual level, and what I think, which is once you do that, you have helped people, you have changed people, you have saved people. Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.